creation myth. In the beginning, there was a pen that drew itself into existence and then drew all the grasses and flowers and then drew all the trees and mountains and then drew all the rivers and lakes and then drew all the firemen and cops and then drew all the militaries and intelligence agencies and then drew all the traitors and murderers and then drew all the victims and the barbed wire. The pen was tired and running low on ink. It knew it could only draw one more thing before running completely dry. It made a list of things it could draw. Art, breakfast, books about insects, bags of oranges, fancy handmade glass paperweights. But at this point in its list, the ink ran out. Without any ink to move itself, the pen was stuck and had to watch as the militaries outlined in its own confident black lines fought against each other, as the traitors with their expertly shaded dark eyes threw their outlines of hand grenades at each other, as the murderers spilled blood on the outlines of flowers, the blood shaded in with thick black cross-hatched lines. If I had to do it all over again, the pen thought, I would have first drawn another pen and then drawn jars of colorful ink. It's not so bad to see blood spilled over the world I've drawn, but it blacks out all my lines. And the pen was correct. This is the first rule of aesthetics. When they are soaked in blood, there is no difference between one tree and another, between a traitor and a soldier. So that's one of the poems from Matthias Valina's first book, Destruction Myth. And basically every single poem in this, with the exception of the last one, is called Creation Myth. And then the last poem in the book, which is the title poem as well, is Destruction Myth. I've known Matthias for probably maybe like a decade. And he's always been, A, one of my favorite poets, but B, one of the most interesting people I've ever had the pleasure of knowing. He has a super interesting, what's a better word than interesting? He has a super eclectic, but at the same time, broad taste in music, from death metal to FK Twigs to, what else do we talk about in here? To 90s UK emo bands that I had no idea. So I met him initially in Nebraska, and he read from my reading series, and that I did with my friend Trey Moody. And one of the things about him is his imagination, which is, again, maybe reductive, but it's really kind of out there. So he writes dreams for a living, and he goes from town to town, has people sign up. We'll put a link on our website, and delivers people their dreams every day. And he starts at like 3 a.m. and he bikes around. And if you've signed up for that month's installation of dreams, he writes you a new dream for the entirety of the month. It's called the Dream Delivery Service. And that's something that, you know, most people might think of on a, or I don't know if they think about it or not, but it's something that, you know, it's the same thing with like a John Cage thing. People say, yeah, that'd be cool, but they don't do it. And I mean, one of the things I really respect about Matthias and admire is he does it. So in this interview, we kind of went back to his own days as a college DJ in Virginia. We kind of jumped all over. And then we hear him at the end read a couple of his, not his latest dreams, but a couple of his kind of canonical, well, the dreams that he likes to read when he's asked to read dreams. So this is the Steers interview with Matthias Valina.
Welcome to the Steer.
Is that good?
Yeah, that's good. That's really kind of like
a good intonation.
Well, I don't mean on the air, but I just mean in general because, well, whatever. Yeah, let's do this.
Okay. And then do you still use Tom's deodorant?
No, I've been kind of sans deodorant for a bit.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, sorry about the being in a small studio with you.
No, I'm quite pleased. But so you quit because that was your deodorant.
That was my go-to for years, for decades maybe, the main wood space.
Which had a scent or did not have a scent?
It had a scent. It had like a slightly, like a little bit of vetiver maybe, a little bit of cedar. I can't remember exactly, but it had like a sort of a woody, spicy, hence the name. But then there was just like a day when I was traveling or something, and I ran out, and then I was like, yeah, and then I never got more.
But you used it for a decade?
At least, yeah.
Huh.
Maybe starting in the 90s? I don't know.
And then, but it's just the switch flipped off and then you never...
If I have to go back to teaching or being in an office situation, that's what I'm going to go back to.
Oh, so deodorant is more for societal norms rather than the way that it made you feel.
Yeah, definitely.
Because yeah. We've had a variation on this conversation, I think, a couple years ago. But it makes me sweat more.
Yeah.
Like, it's, what's the thing? It's psychosomatic.
Mm-hmm.
But I wear it just because I kind of, everyone else wears it.
Yeah. I mean, one advantage.
But you broke past that.
I devolved it, maybe. I don't know. It's also like being pretty broke all the time. I'll make arbitrary sacrifices. So I'll be like, oh, I can't get deodorant, but I will, like the next day, order Thai food or something. You know, like.
Sure.
So there would be like really inexplicable money-saving choices along the way.
But you also are leading a somewhat different life than teaching, right? Because
yeah,
you're on the road how many months out of the year?
Depending on how you interpret on the road, I guess maybe all of them. But
how do you interpret on the road?
I feel like I'm on the road even though I'm here in Portland this month just because I'm doing this project and then I'll move along.
Mm-hmm.
I was in Colorado for a couple months, which felt sort of like tagging in or, I don't know, returning to some kind of home base, but I don't feel like I have like a home there or anything.
Because you first moved to Denver.
2009.
Oh, 10 years ago.
Yeah.
So off and on you have, but you don't have like an apartment there now.
No, I got rid of everything, pretty much everything I owned and haven't had an apartment since 2016.
Oh.
But I've stayed there for a couple months at a time doing other stuff.
Sure. So you've been here for a month, but then you're staying. Do you have a bed?
I have a sleeping bag and a sleeping pad with a hole in it.
The hole doesn't allow for good sleeping?
Just doesn't keep air, so.
Oh, gosh, really?
Before I get back on the road, I need to patch it. This is just my to-do list now.
Right.
I have to patch my sleeping pad.
Well, I'm not trying to rag on you.
I have to get some deodorant.
And you're biking, too, to everywhere.
As much as I can. Some of it I'll fly and ship my bike out, so. I flew from the East Coast out here and shipped my bike from Denver before I went out to the East Coast. And after I do Dreams in Boise in September, I'll fly back to the East Coast to get to Durham for November.
So, but you'll be biking to Boise?
Yeah, between here and Seattle and Boise, I'll be biking.
And then that's a lot of solitude.
I hope so, yeah.
Oh, so solitude, I mean, is that kind of why you started? Solitude?
Yeah, in 2016, I flew into Seattle and biked out to the coast and biked down to LA and then up to Joshua Tree. And that was the first long distance biking I'd ever done and really just fell in love with it and immediately wanted to figure out ways of framing more of my life around that. So that solitude, I'd never really done much in solitude before and it was really appealing to me.
I mean, you consider yourself a people person?
I like people. I don't know. I feel like I have a semi-desperate desire to be liked by people.
A semi-desperate desire in a way different than other people?
I don't know. I can't speak for other people.
Well, I mean, I would say I have a desire to be liked by people, but it also borders on neediness.
Yeah, I think I have that and that I find myself willing to twist myself and my, I don't know, not desires, but my sense of self to fit other people or what I perceive to be other people's expectations a lot.
You mold your sense of self to what they think that you should be or what they kind of want yeah. you to be?
Which, I mean, obviously we all do, but I don't like how that molding has worked for me. And so finding... I don't know. Solitude, I don't know if it really works in opposition to that or in contrast to that. I just don't have to be doing that, maybe. So I get to just be on my bike and read books and sleep in my tent. And usually I have a next destination that I'm trying to get to where I'm going to go and do the dream delivery thing again.
Mm-hmm.
So I have an end in sight. I don't feel like I'm just transient, like transient toward a thing.
Well, because you have friends kind of all over, which is cool. It's not like you're staying at a Best Western.
Sometimes.
Oh, really? But not for like a month.
Oh, no. No. Yeah, I'm staying. My friends run a little community art gallery up in Montevilla, the 1122 gallery. And the gallery is just built out of their garage, and they have a little side room to that, so I'm staying there.
Mm-hmm.
In Seattle, I'm staying at the Broken... I'm staying in a broken sauna at the Rockland Residency, which is an artist residency up there.
They said this is a broken sauna. That was delineated in the...
Well, they normally do one-week residencies for artists. My friend C and Juliet Lee had gotten me in touch with them, and they like what I was doing, and they're like, yeah, but it doesn't fit our project. We do have this Birkin sauna. I was like, that's perfect. That's,
sign me up.
That's more than I need. Yeah. I mean, I feel like all I need is just somewhere to set up my tent, and I would be fine for the month as long as I can use a, like, plug in my computer and printer and have somewhere to keep my bike safe. That's pretty much, I have low standards of comfort.
Low. They're different standards than other people. Low makes it sound like...
Oh, I didn't mean that pejorative. I just meant like I don't need...
You don't need...
Comfort or privacy or stuff like that.
Hence the lack of toms.
There's that too.
So, and then you're biking. We're biking.
Yeah.
And then are you listening? Do you listen to music?
I listen to audiobooks while I'm biking because if I listen to music, I can't hear the road and I feel like that's unsafe.
Okay.
But with the, I'll keep either, if there's traffic, I'll keep one earbud in. If there's not, I'll listen to both. And so I listen to a lot of plot-driven crime novels and a lot of kind of pop history and pop science. And then I have these aspirational audiobooks of like, you know, Plato's Middle Dialogues to... which I haven't read comprehensively since I was an undergrad, and things like that that are on my old iPod, and I'll listen to about 2 minutes of them and then be like, no, I'd rather listen to that Mary Roach book about poop or something.
Oh, I just have it's about sex and science. Have you listened to that one, Mary Roach?
No. I've actually never listened to any Mary Roach. I just feel like she represents the kind of thing that works for me.
I know what you mean, because I haven't read this book either, but it's been sitting on my coffee table for like a couple months. I think it's called, Bang. Maybe that's...
Yeah, that sounds right.
No, it's Sex and Science. That's too much. I don't think it's called Bang.
But like her other book is Gulp. And yeah,
you know,
she does like the one word titles.
It's something along those lines. Now, so you listen, is it like Dan Brown styles, Malcolm Gladwell? Like just stuff that's fun, kind of.
I've read every Dan Brown Da Vinci Code novel.
You've read it or you listened?
I've read those.
They're pretty good, eh?
And they're terrible.
Oh my gosh, really, are you serious?
I mean, they're like, you know, they're a really strict form and a really strict genre. And yeah, every chapter has to end on like a crashing...
Yeah, they're short chapters.
Yeah, just ridiculously bad plotting. And
oh my God, why did you read them then?
Oh, because I've read every Michael Crichton novel. I've read every...
Including Congo?
Including, yeah, Michael... I mean, Michael Crichton's a scumbag.
Oh, but is that true?
Yeah, he was like a real right-wing paranoiac.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he was terrible. He was like not quite Tom Clancy level of like right-wing paranoia, but... You know, up there, hated the Japanese in the 80s.
That's well known of Michael Crichton that he was not a good person.
I mean, you can get it from his books. I don't know personally if he just wrote about those topics or.
You can, but yeah, see, I don't think I've ever actually. Did he do Jurassic Park?
He did Jurassic Park and Andromeda Strain and Sphere and Congo and.
And you've read them all.
Yeah, they would. Oh, you know, the one I love is Timeline, which is also a really great movie with. Paul Walker.
What's the premise of... Paul Walker. What's the premise of Timeline?
Every Michael Crichton novel is like he read an article in Scientific American and just stole all the jargon words and then just builds like a really terrible plot around like throwing out some jargon words here and there.
Sure.
So this one is a quantum time machine kind of thing that has to send Paul Walker back in time for some reason. I can't quite remember. And Paul Walker, rest in peace, you know, is a sort of a beautiful... symbol of like idealized mediocrity or something like that.
A beautiful symbol of idealized mediocrity.
Yeah, like he's like this version of kind of plain whiteness that even he doesn't seem to want to be. I don't know. And he only has like one acting trick, which is like kind of tilt his head and smile. You know, it's like
in the film or in general.
In general, his whole career. I love him. I mean, I love him in Fast and Furious. I love like I was
his entire catalog. You enjoy?
I was going to say that, and then I realized I haven't actually seen his whole oeuvre. So it would be.
But you have seen Timeline.
Many times, yeah. I saw it in theaters. I read the book when it came out. I think maybe before it came out in an ARC. So I was working in the bookstore I worked at in Richmond at the time. And yeah, it was, I would just kind of hate read every Michael Crichton novel. And
you would you read them fast?
Yeah, they take like 12 seconds to read. They're like, you know, they're like Dan Brown. It's just like, if you look at them, you have read the whole book, basically.
Yeah, but does any of this, you think, show up in your dreams? Because you're biking and you're listening to this stuff, I mean, directly or indirectly?
I don't know. I mean, the things I listen to when I'm biking, I just had to, like, the first time I did a bike trip, the only book I brought with me was Henry James' The Golden Bowl, because it had been sitting on my shelf for decades, and I was like, I'm finally going to read The Golden Bowl. You know, his, like, masterwork of his late career, you know, the great sentence, and got, like, 4 pages into it the first night of camping. I was like, this is the exact wrong book to have on this trip.
Why? What's the... See, I don't think I've ever read anything by Henry James.
Oh, I mean,
he's wordy, right?
Amazing. Yeah, oh. Incredibly wordy and long set piece scenes that sort of intertwine within one another and push an idea along. I'm thinking more of the later books now. Push an idea along through these long set pieces. You know, so there might be, I don't know, I'm guessing here, but like a 35-page chapter about a man walking across town, you know, mm-hmm. with all these like kind of background layering and this and that. And I still haven't read all of Golden Bowl, but having read 100 pages of it, you know, it's very methodically progressing through this world and these big concepts that he wants to sort of test out in the world. And I think he was one of Stein's favorite writers.
Well, William James was Stein's teacher, right?
Yeah.
That was the thing, yeah.
Yeah, but like the sentence structures and the
right.
the style of complexity and like constant self-interruption, self-correction inside of sentences and that kind of thing is something I love. And especially later James, like the earlier Washington Park stuff, the more kind of comedy of manners I'm less into.
But for The Golden Bowl, you read 4 pages on your first biking trip.
Yeah, and like, then I tossed it to a thrift store and bought a Michael Connelly crime novel and read that. And
because it was too involved for this first, I mean, why?
It didn't match what my mind could do on the road, which was like stay more inside of a surface level approach to the world and a sort of desire to be like looking.
Well, you have to be kind of careful too, biking. If you're like parsing, you know, James's sentences while a semi's coming. Frankly,
and anything that I would stop and try to appreciate a sentence of, I can't listen to an audiobook of too. So, plot-driven stuff, information-driven stuff that is not so complex that I need to actually think through the arguments of it. Like that's great for the road,
right?
Like I probably listened to maybe 10 or 12 books. Biking around, delivering here.
Oh, so I mean, that's just so you get through them. Then I guess you. So how you biked this morning? Obviously.
Yeah, I did half my delivery because I woke up late, and so I'm going to do the other half after this.
Oh, okay. So what's a full delivery? Though? How long would that take this month at least?
4.5 hours.
Oh gosh, so you really are okay.
So, a lot of audiobooks range from the 8 to 12 hours length.
So you can get through them.
Yeah. So I usually go through a book every 2 or 3 days.
Do you have Audible?
I have Audible and there's library sites and
yeah. What's it? LibriVox, is it called Canvas?
I don't know about that one.
Okay. But so they're not like super costly. I tried to listen to Hallucinations by Oliver Sacks.
Mm-hmm.
It was, I don't know if it was a sentence level thing, but I couldn't really get into it. And yeah. I really like Oliver Sacks. Have you ever?
I haven't read that one, but I've read a lot of his, other stuff. Had a teacher in MFA school who assigned The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat in a workshop.
Oh.
I can't remember exactly what the pedagogy of it was. I think he just liked the book.
And then he was buff.
Oliver, yeah. He was buff?
He was buff.
I didn't know this.
Oh my gosh. No, he was really into weightlifting. Wow. He was a very muscular man.
He was a bear?
He could have been, I mean, I guess maybe. Huh. We'll look at photos. All right, let's play a song that you sent me, and then we'll briefly talk about it. Does that sound good?
Sounds good. Blood, dart, fuck his politics.
You say I can dance in here?
I say I like your dance move in there.
That's right. UUVVWWZ. Tell me about your relationship with them.
They pronounced it WWVWWZ.
Okay, because Paul Hanson Clark. Okay, say it again.
WWVWWZ.
WWVWWZ.
But it was also, you know, that's kind of a joke too.
I thought, and see, he would always just say UU. Paul did.
Yeah.
I feel like because they would say it again.
WWVWWZ.
Okay.
The idea is that it's, you know, the end of like the alphabet that would be listed on the top of a kindergarten class chalkboard.
Sure.
So UUV, you know, with the uppercase and the lowercase. And
right. Well, yeah, what's going on with them for you?
They were just an amazing band from Lincoln, Nebraska, where I lived for a few years. They were, you know, moving from the East Coast to Lincoln was sort of a confusing feeling of just kind of what to expect out of arts and politics and people out there. And
where in the East Coast were you before you were in Lincoln?
I was in Richmond for a while before then.
Richmond, Virginia.
Virginia, yeah. And they were one of the groups of folks that I met who were very passionate about the music and the other projects they were working on. And the singer for the band, Teal Gardner, is a good friend and now is in Boise working in the arts. And
what's she doing in Boise?
She's working with an arts organization that I don't know many details about.
Okay.
And making art and yeah.
And so you were in Lincoln from when to when?
When was it? 04 to 09, I think.
04
to 08.
Well, because when I moved to Lincoln was 08, and I want to say that you and Zach Schomburg,
just left,
you
right?
Both left. Did you leave at the same time as Zach?
Yeah, Zach moved out here and I moved to Brooklyn.
Okay, yeah, then that was 08. And so had their first album came out by then?
Yeah, their first album had come out. Yeah, and the second one that we're just listening to a song from
had
The Trusted Language was just coming out when I moved because I remember I saw them at the cake shop in Manhattan after I'd moved out to Brooklyn. And if you've been to shows in New York, maybe it's like here, I don't know. You know, there's so many bands coming through all the time and so many local bands that people sort of show up in the smaller shows for the band they want to see and don't tend to pay attention to the other bands.
Right.
And so WWVWWZ were first of five or six bands at the cake shop, you know, this cool little underground space.
This is for the Trusted Language.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they were the first band I'd seen in New York that no one was paying attention to except me and another person who was friends with them. At their first song, mm-hmm. And then by their third song, everybody had stopped talking in the back of the room and come to the front and were watching them, and they're ahead, like, won over a crowd in a way that I don't think I've seen jaded New Yorkers won over before or since.
Well, that's kind of powerful. Like, I saw them on that tour play at Mississippi Studios here in Portland, and it wasn't, you know, it was decently attended.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how many people there, doesn't really matter, but I know Teal a little bit when I lived in Nebraska. And then actually when I moved to Omaha in 2016, she was moving to Boise.
Right.
But did this album come out in 2013, I think? 2014? I think it came out in 2013. No, maybe it doesn't really make a difference. But anyways, they didn't have that many people. They put on an amazing show, and that's the only time I ever saw them. But didn't mm-hmm. in Lincoln they play it atop of the Bourbon?
Yeah, I wasn't there then.
Okay, but what was the... Because they were they were assigned to Saddle Creek.
Mm-hmm. They were well-loved in Lincoln and, yeah, just never really made a lot of impact outside of the area.
Well, they kind of made a small impact.
Yeah.
They're definitely loved in Nebraska. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think so. The guitarist is his name, John Tollerman. Jim?
Jim, yeah.
Sorry. His name's Jim. So when
you said John, and all I could think was John.
Well, when I lived in Omaha, I ran into him you know, quite a few times. And he was
touring with Simon Joyner.
Yeah. And I asked him, I said the name of the band wrong, which is now embarrassing. And he didn't correct me. So now I feel like a total asshole.
But it's a band name that's impossible to know how to pronounce correctly. So even having the like even more slightly contrived way of pronouncing the name is a joke.
Yeah,
I think.
I guess. WWVWWZ. I still can't, but I really like them. I have both their records. They're on my Zoom.
They're great.
But anyways, I asked him and he was like, well, Teal, I don't know. He's like, Teal moved away. I my friend Trey Moody introduced me to them. Mm-hmm. And then Paul Hanson Clark's really close with Teal.
Teal's a poet as well.
Teal's a poet as well. Did the Space Gallery, was involved with Space Gallery?
Yeah, I think involved with. I don't know.
I mean, do you get nostalgic when you like listen to this stuff? Or when you just think about those moments? Are you a nostalgic person by your nature?
No. I try to cut off all nostalgia-forming mechanisms that I can. I think nostalgia is toxic on almost every level.
Well, I know. I think a lot of people think that way, and especially a lot of artists, because they want to like move forward and they want to like progress. I mean, is that why? Or because looking back is just, it just seems stupid.
No, just I feel like nostalgia idealizes inherently, and you know, so much of like the contrarian and self-deluding politics of the day are based in sort of nostalgia for ideas of gender, nostalgia for ideas of a country that are inherently flawed and have never actually existed. And so
that
I think nostalgia for, you know, there's been, now that my generation's all middle-aged and stuff, there's been such a wave of like reunion shows of indie rock bands who never played for more than 200 people back then. And I always feel good for the bands, like, great, get a paycheck, but I have no interest in going to those kind of shows and cultivating that nostalgia for, I don't know, a time that was, for me, really mixed up and trying to idealize that history through the soundtracks of it seems kind of gross to me.
Sure.
For other people, but...
Right, but I mean, even like a phrase like "Make America Great Again" was a Reagan phrase. It wasn't even Trump's, and it was also harkening back to... But I mean, you talk about bands, like I saw Jawbreaker play last summer at the Crystal Ballrooms, one of the biggest venues here in town. $50 a ticket.
Yeah.
I mean, that's expensive.
Yeah. Good for them, man.
I know. Good for them. No. And I mean, the show is all right. But I mean, it is interesting because I think in their heyday, I guess they were an opening act for Nirvana. But I mean,
the only time I saw them was maybe like 150 people.
Right. Where was that at?
Was it Black Cat? It might have been Black Cat.
Carolina?
No, in D.C.
Oh, okay. Is that venue's pretty small?
It probably held like 600.
Oh, so then they didn't really fill it out.
Nah, a few of the indie bands at that time, really, unless they were D.C. bands, would like fill it out. I think Elliot Smith, when I saw him after Good Will Hunting came out, was like the first sold-out show I think I saw there.
At Black Cat?
Yeah.
Huh.
Did the lighting just change in here?
Yeah, it did.
somebody alerting us?
I don't think so.
Is it because I said Elliot Smith in Portland?
I think that's true. That's a light. A light shines whenever you say that. All right, now we're going to do one more. Then...
It's such a good song.
The Far Side.
Yeah.
Running. Lavin Cabin, California. What's your relationship like with Farside in that song? Why that song in particular, actually?
It's one of those songs that has never stopped being sort of, I don't know, my like go-to playlist of songs, like, you know, from 95, I guess. And hearing it, I was in college, and immediately that sort of minor key, wistful element to that song felt very, you know, kind of in keeping with like Tribe or Jungle Brothers or some of the other Native Tongue stuff, but a whole different emotional tone for a hip-hop song to me. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and as somebody who has built a life of running away from things, it's, I think, emotionally resonant and just that kind of core message.
Don't be too hard on yourself. We're all running away from things, whether physically, emotionally, spiritually. Maybe you're all three. Nothing wrong with that.
It's just such a beautiful song. It's like, you know, you think of like, not that they're a one-hit wonder or something, you know, and Fat Lip is amazing and the solo stuff too. And they're, you know, they're still playing around, and you do one song like that of your career and you're just, you know, you can check out with pride. Like that's such a beautiful, perfect song.
Now, do you, cause I think this did come out in 95. Did you buy this? Where were you in 95?
I was in Fredericksburg, Virginia at Mary Washington College, and I was working at the radio station. So I remember having heard their first record, or I don't know if they had one before that, and kind of getting this in the mail when it was, you know, a white label promo, and putting it in and having it on in the room. And I remember like just that coming on and being like, oh, this is the jam. Okay.
Well, that must
because I was the music director, so I was listening for the jam, you know, to recommend like the songs.
This is 95 college radio, so you were kind of a big deal.
We was the tiniest little radio station.
Still, I'm sure.
AM that didn't broadcast off campus, but it was sort of, I was at this little school, you know, with like 3,000 students, and it was a pretty conservative liberal arts college. Uh-huh. So if you wanted to do anything that was in the arts, you did it. You know, you were in charge of the radio station. If you liked music, you were.
Are you saying in a positive way, or you mean?
Yeah, it meant, as compared to like maybe if I'd gone to a Research One school or something like that, where hundreds of people probably are wanting to run the radio station.
Right. So there was, it was 3,000 students. So it was pretty small.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, half of them were sort of older South kind of mentality.
Fredericksburg, Virginia.
Yeah.
Okay. Big town, small town, college town?
Small town, not a college town, but a small southern town, about an hour south of D.C. and an hour north of Richmond, right on the Rappahannock. The Battle of Fredericksburg is one that Whitman wrote about.
Okay.
And it was both secluded, but with a lot of access to D.C. and Richmond, so it felt like a little liberal arts enclave in a way, but within an hour we could be in town to see big shows or go to museums or be around the big city.
And were you English major? Were you already arts dude?
I was,
as I consider you,
trying to be I really wanted to be a medievalist, so I was had a split major between history and English with a focus on medieval studies, but I was terrible at languages and scholarship, which are the kind of fundamental pillars of being a medievalist.
Did you realize that at the time? Did you switch?
No, my advisor had like a sort of intervention with me, Dr. Bruce O'Brien, where he's like, you know, your Latin's not very good and you've been trying to take Italian and dropping out of it, and doesn't look like your French is happening, and you haven't even studied Greek, and and your, you know, your papers that you're writing aren't the strongest arguments. It was sort of this moment where he's like, okay, you have this fantasy that you might become a medievalist, but that's never going to happen, young sir.
But was your interest in, why did you want to be a medievalist in the first place? You reading when you were young something, or what was the...
I mean, realistically, probably just like a straight line from reading too much Tolkien as a kid and being obsessed with that. But what had developed as I studied more history was sort of a fascination with the way that, you know, the lack of sources in a lot of medieval periods made interpretations so open and variable, and how myths of the medieval era then get sort of filled in and invented to create either through lines to the classical era or, you know, national myths of fantasies, really, and just how a lot of the modern forms that we take for granted in law, in politics, in history hadn't been codified at that point. So, you know, books were weird. Structures of law were weird. And, you know, the fact that, you know, there is still a common law, you know,
right.
out of English law, you know, this sort of weird unwritten rule stuff comes out of that core. So that's what I was fascinated with, like the weirdness of it.
But the language, I mean, how many languages were you supposed to learn as a medievalist at that school?
I can passably translate Latin when given
still,
time.
So then, I mean, you're hard on yourself. You can still do that to this day?
I probably could if you gave me a lot of time still, because it's very jigsaw puzzly.
Right, but you
but
could
only
figure it out.
Classical Latin, yeah. And the kind of familiarity with language that would allow me to effectively translate, I didn't have. And
sure.
That's the stuff, that's what I was interested in too, was like the, I don't know, maybe 8th to 11th centuries, like before the 12th century Renaissance, before the Crusades, when things were like really in foment. And yeah, I didn't have the skill set and wasn't going to build it, since I was busy going to punk rock shows and putting on poetry readings and stuff instead of studying as much as I should have.
And being the music director of the local radio station.
Yeah.
And when you found this, I mean, was it, did you say so you, I mean, this must have been, see, I live all this stuff and kind of, you know, because in 95, I was what, 11? Was that a big, I mean, because now it's 2019.
Yeah.
I mean, that must have been exciting. I haven't really.
Yeah, there's not, I mean, there's not a lot of like hip hop that I'm like, that I still love from that time. Like, mm-hmm. I still love Tribe. I don't actually listen to like Jungle Brothers, even though I probably listened to that every day back then.
Sure.
Know? Like, there's a lot of stuff from that era. I don't know.
Native tongues, like De La, and like, oh, is yeah. that what you kind of grasped onto?
Yeah.
Yeah. Beat Nuts?
Yeah. Like, they're a band that, like, I probably put on mixtapes back then, but
right,
probably.
Right, so did I, yeah.
Yeah. Or.
But this one has stuck, I guess.
Yeah. Or like, you know, how many Eric Sermon records did I maybe have that, you know, I remember one song from still, you know, but this song is always sort of at the front of my music thinking.
What now? We can move on a second, but what were the other members' names other than Fatlip? Do you remember?
No idea.
Yeah. I hope they're doing well.
They came through Denver a little while back. My friend Steven and I
Far
were talking
side?
About going. Yeah, without Fatlip.
Okay.
Yeah, my friend Steven and I were talking about going, and then I think we just wanted to talk about maybe going and then
right.
and not really go.
Wow, but this album, yeah, is. All right, let's...
It's such great production, too. It's just like a really full sound with... Yeah, it doesn't sound like...
Well,
yeah.
Yeah, and especially for 95. I mean, there are other things in that kind of
mm-hmm.
lane, as it were, but I mean, there was a lot of like organs and stuff on this record.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, not that... All right, let's do this one, which I know nothing about, so you can tell me a little bit about.
Yeah.
Boy Racer, A Friend for Life. Who's Boy Racer?
I don't know the guy's name. They were a British band. Maybe they still exist. I don't even know. They were a British band from the 90s, as far as I knew them. Kind of loved, you know, the early Wedding Present, kind of really agitated guitar pop stuff and real lo-fi. And they're just those that kind of band that in the 90s would have a new release on flexi disc or cassette tape or, you know, split 7-inch with some even lesser known band. Like every week there'd be a new Boy Racer release, and I was such a sucker for that kind of mode of release at that time.
Is this in college too?
High school or college, yeah.
And so then. In high school, what were you? I mean, were you always kind of a jack of all trades in terms of music, or were you rap is crap when you were?
No, I always, I mean, you know, as a kid, it was sort of, we all, I remember like being in elementary school and like we all had the Run-DMC tape and the Motley Crue tape.
You know?
And that was sort of like the, like later, I think it was like the, everybody got like the Boyz II Men and Nirvana, you know, and then the same, same holiday. Yeah.
Interesting.
It was that sort of suburban thing where we were sort of looking both directions. I remember like thinking it was like my friend Ray Healy had a band called Vitapup.
Ray Healy, Vitapup.
Yeah. And they were this amazing kind of hardcore and hip hop band from the village, from, you know, East Village in New York in the 90s, but not like a metalcore, like punk hip hop sort of stuff that came up with Limp Bizkit and Korn and all that. They were, you know, they were like a band that loved Born Against and Fugazi and also loved, you know, Tribe Called Quest and De La, and tried to figure out ways to not so successfully integrate them. But
and you were friends with the lead singer, or you?
He was a, my really good friend's brother. But there was that mode where like you're just kind of looking in these two directions. I mean, like this is radical music in two different like iterations for this time period.
But right. A lot of people around you were kind of willing. I mean, I grew up in Nevada, and I think in high school and in middle school, I mean, maybe less so in college, it was kind of delineated. You know, like people liked rock or people liked country. Country was like, yeah, I like country and I don't like anything else. You know, like, but you're, and like now people younger than me, because of streaming, because of all these things, you know, no one really only listens to like urban R&B or something.
Right.
You know, like it's just kind of.
Although if you're going to choose one genre.
I think so, yeah. Right? But I mean, it's a different world. But like, it was like, if I'm going to buy a CD, I'm only going to buy CDs in this genre. Maybe that was just my own kind of growing up experience. It wasn't like that for you, though. It was kind of...
I mean, I was definitely mostly interested in punk rock and indie rock, but...
But you were willing, yeah.
There was this, you know, you can't put that on at a party either, you know? Like,
Boy Racer, you totally can.
You're not going to have a fun party, you know? So...
Well, there was, it depends on the party.
Yeah, the dance music and hip hop was sort of what I feel like was on at parties, and you know, and especially with Native Tongues and that stuff, like the crossover effect. And you know, Basshead from DC was another crossover back then. They're not as remembered anymore, but
yeah, he was Basshead.
Yeah, Basshead DC.
Basshead DC is the name of the band.
Yeah, he was Basshead, and you know, because of name overlap, I think
right.
But he was sort of a hip-hop mumble folk guy, like a sort of cross between D'Angelo and, I don't even know, like Smog, maybe?
Huh. D'Angelo and Smog? Bill Callahan Smog?
Yeah.
Interesting. That's an interesting mix.
Yeah, he was this really fascinating guy who had a weird trajectory through the industry that sort of never really gave him his due. But, yeah, there was this sort of crossovers between people who, like, thought they only liked... pure music, like rock and roll was somehow pure, you know. And then everyone I knew hated country. I mean, that was a solid.
Really? Because you grew up where? In Virginia?
Yeah, in the burbs of D.C. That's where I was in high school.
And it was no country. No country for...
Mm-hmm. No country for pretentious young men. Yeah, it was sort of a no country and probably less interest in sort of the softer side of R&B.
Sure.
The things that I was interested in, or the circles I was interested in, were kind of anti-corporate and anti-pop music and this and that. So it was, as long as it was sort of coming at things from the margins, I was interested in it, and which is maybe still how I think of music a lot of the times.
Well, I was going to say, do those tenets kind of stick with you to this day? Or, I mean, are you completely different? I mean, you said at the margins.
Yeah. I mean, I tend to gravitate towards... the weirder side of whatever genre I'm interested in musically. So if I like something like ambient music, you know, then I drift into getting interested in Coil and sort of occult ambient like stuff. And
is that the same with writing too, or like writers you like?
I don't know. I definitely went through a period with music. I wanted to know all the little stuff. I wanted to know the 7 inches, and I wanted to know the you know, the labels they were from and like who else was on that label and this and that. And I went through a period with publishing or with poetry and indie publishing and the sort of the tradition of indie publishing where that was very similar to that desire to know all the indie rock labels. And so I wanted to know, you know, everything about Angel Hair, and I wanted to know about the punk band and then also the magazine. I wanted to know, you
which
know,
is
like,
a New York poetry that yeah, didn't Berrigan'd it or no?
Yeah, from the 70s. Okay. And, you know, I wanted to know like how Diane DePrima like cut through different things. And, you know, I wanted to know this sort of relationships and who did Toothpaste Press and which books came out with Toothpaste Press and, you know, things like that. And so I was interested in that sort of baseball card statistics approach to knowing it.
Is this grad school or is this undergrad?
More right. In grad school. And okay. When there was sort of the new boom of indie publishing in the mid-2000s that Octopus was part of, you know, it sort of felt relevant to thinking through how all this cheaper technology of publishing and all this cheaper technology and access or open access of the internet was sort of different from, but still extending from, you know, photocopied or Xeroxed magazines in New York in the 70s and letterpress stuff and, you know, really small scale approach to publishing that had been happening all along in different ways with poetry.
Sure. And I mean, every generation, I mean, kind of, they, for me, I'm a bit younger than you. I mean, I didn't know at that time about Angel Hair or anything. So it seemed like that none of this stuff had ever happened in any iteration ever before. So mm-hmm. It was very exciting, you know.
Yeah.
You had a little bit more lineage in history, but it was still, I mean, kind of a big deal, you know.
And I was learning that stuff while we're starting a little press too.
Right. Well, and it's an ongoing little press.
It is.
All right, let's do one.
Still little.
What?
Luckily, still little.
Yeah. So let's do one song that got 3 million views in the past couple days. So yeah. Then we can use Paradox. Kind of hard to stop that, but
yeah, it's such a good song.
FKA Twigs, Cellophane. Why?
I just think she's brilliant. That first record was one of my favorite full records that of the last decade, I think. And the way that she mixes, you know, very simple balladry with dubstep production and a kind of shoegazy or Cocteau Twins almost atmosphere building. I just love. And then she had, I can't remember the details. She had been ill for a little bit or something and had meow, meow, meow and whatever and hadn't released anything in a couple of years. And then,
yeah, it's been a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, and then that song and that video came out last week, 2 weeks ago.
I think last week. Yeah.
And I think I watched it 20 times just while I was doing other work and listening to it over and over again for that day. And yeah, it's as a 43-year-old middle-aged dude, I feel like it's rarer to have like high impact moments with any work of art.
Sure. Because you've seen so much, and I mean, not that you're 90, but...
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to cultivate something that works in opposition to the diminishing returns of art.
Cultivate something that... Say that again?
You have to work to not be jaded.
You have to work... No, that's true. Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, it's sort of like when you're young and you're coming into finding out about art and books and music, you know, and you don't have a lot of background with it. Like, I felt like my mind was blown at every show I went to and every reading I went to when I was a kid, and every book was sort of transformative, and it was because I had such a small set to put it in relation to. And at this point, I feel like I'm, even when I love something, it's, you know, sort of fitting comfortably into structures of love or
sure,
familiar landscapes of love.
Disseminated into your mental kind of framework.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So when something arrives and really floors me, I get very excited.
And then how'd you discover this? I mean, are you Spotify?
Follow her on Twitter.
Yeah. Oh, you follow her on Twitter. Yeah. Oh. Is that how you discover a lot of music?
No.
How do you find out about, because you're biking, you're not listening to music then. I mean, is it friends?
I used
friends?
To be a record store dude. And when I got rid of all my stuff, I got rid of maybe like 2,000 records.
Gosh. So you, because I remember I sent you the Eileen record and you.
Yeah.
But
and
you,
I left that with Phil Cordelli and Sarah Boyer. So yeah. that's in good hands.
No, I'm not saying 3.5 years later, where is it? I couldn't notice that you didn't bring it to this interview. So,
I was.
But you had 2,000 records. So that's a lot. I mean, so you...
And some were, you know, some were like ones that I bought when I was 13.
Which you were had sentimental value or which were crappy?
Probably both. Both. Yeah. But, you know, just indie rock and punk rock stuff from back then or, you know, or like the copy of Velvet Underground and Nico that I bought from the scratched up dollar bin at Record Convergence in Fairfax, Virginia. You know, still
and
had.
You just, this was time.
Yeah, I was at a point where I'd been trying to let go of a lot of things in my life in various ways. And I was getting some interest about the dream delivery thing that I'd done a couple times in Denver from people in other cities and from a couple sort of institutions in other cities. And to do it in a way that seemed like I could do, because I've never had a lot of money and I'm not very good at planning things or things that people do. I don't know. I was like, well, if I just get rid of, if I don't have a home and I have no stuff, and then that'll free me up to just travel around and do the dream thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was 3 years ago?
Yeah, it was 2016.
Okay.
But maybe...
Three and a half years ago?
I might be getting the order wrong, too. I think I did the bike ride. I got rid of all my stuff before I went on that long bike ride without really knowing what I was going to do when I landed, and then...
But you were tired of... Because I have a lot of old stuff, but I've moved, you know, I've moved to Omaha in 2016, moved back here in 2018, moved to Lincoln in 2008, moved back here in 20... Like, I've moved around, and I carted around, and even if sometimes I have physical space, the mental space, it doesn't... So was it freeing just to be like... Do you ever...
It was really... I had an estate sale for myself and invited all my friends over to just grab whatever they wanted. And if they wanted to give me some money, like whatever they thought would be like appropriate. But I would also, you know, as an old bookseller, as an old record store employee, I'd be like, oh, well, take this too. And so everybody would walk out with big handfuls of books and records and whatever art was on my walls and stuff like that. And
that you'd had for years.
Yeah. And it felt good sort of spreading it out to my friends and having them take the stuff. I still have a couple boxes of like the really sentimental books that are in my friend Summer Browning's garage. And, probably being eaten by mice right now or something.
But. Yeah, those books aren't there anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
But no regret, no remorse. 3.5 years later, you're never like, because I mean, it is a load off, and you feel like maybe, I mean, they're not being read every day, but that place, that stuff is with people who maybe will get something out of it that I once did.
Yeah. No, I think it was just sort of like that. That was my habit of like getting books from used bookstores and records from record stores. And I had that habit since I was 13. And so they just kept
accumulating.
And I didn't have anything else in life. And so it's not like I had like, you know, a house and, you know, wonderful things. I just had a bunch of books and records.
Wonderful. It's how you define wonderful. Okay. I mean,
expensive things.
Okay. That's different. There we go. All right, so before I have two final questions. What's the story with Sam Elliott?
Oh, man, he's just really, really hot.
He is attractive, is it?
Sam Elliott in Roadhouse, I think, is like the most attractive man other than maybe James Harden. Like, those are my two types. Like, Sam Elliott in Roadhouse and James Harden circa right now.
So facial hair is important.
I guess so, but it's more like the way that the facial hair makes the eyes so, for both of those guys, I'm not saying facial hair across the board. I tend to not be attracted to like a dude with a beard that I see on the street, but the way that for both of them, the facial hair makes the eyes more expressive, makes the eyes sort of deeper.
I can see that. I think I can see that with James Harden. Maybe I don't know Sam Elliott as...
I mean, for him, there's like a mirthful, you know, sort of trickster element to his eyes that, you know...
Sure.
Yeah, if you've seen Sam Elliott without the mustache in movies...
Well, and I was just going to ask you, I don't know if I have. Well, did he have the mustache in that A Star Is Born film that I never saw, on airplanes, I would look over and like, everyone was watching. It was mental.
People love that. Yeah.
But he was in, I think he had a mustache in that too. I'm almost positive he did.
I know there's some movies as background for anybody who cares. I will draw a dream of Sam Elliott in the Dream Delivery Service. So maybe 3 or so out of every 1,000 that I write for a month will be a drawing of Sam Elliott with a little dream.
You draw, but you mean you actually physically draw him?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
He's one of the two things I can draw. I can draw Sam Elliott and I can draw a duck. So
okay.
Whenever I need to draw something, I either draw Sam Elliott or a duck.
So every 1,000th dream will incorporate a drawing of Sam Elliott.
Yeah, and I really want to make a book of dreams of Sam Elliott.
Oh, really? Like a full thing?
Of drawings of dreams of Sam Elliott, yeah.
Drawings of dreams of Sam Elliott.
I don't want the book to ever exist. I just want to keep wanting to make that book.
Sure, yeah. It's better in imagination. And then, that was one of my questions. And then my second question is, who's John Pack? Is he a photographer?
John Pack
is... You've dedicated a lot of your books to him, or you've dedicated a couple.
Yeah, he's like a metaphysically complete creature.
Well, and then didn't you do a thing where he went like this or this?
Yeah, we used to do John Pack Approves or Disapproves, which was a little blog where people could send in things for John Pack to approve or disapprove of. So it was a purely binary review site. And yeah, we would do that for like a couple weeks and then forget about it for 6 months and then do it for a couple weeks.
But who is he?
He is a friend of mine from college. He's a photographer. He's mostly working in set photography for films these days and TV shows in New York. He did a really amazing book with Gary, the guy who did the Helvetica documentary, Gary Huswit or something like that. A book called Olympic City that was street photography of the Olympic villages now. So some of them are ruins. Some of them have been developed and were planned to be developed into like really good housing. The Lake Placid ones turned into a prison.
That's 1980, right?
Yeah.
Oh, they turned into a prison?
Or 80. It was the 80 winter, right?
I think it was the 80 winter.
Because 80, we didn't do summer ones.
Oh, yeah. It was either 80 or 84, Lake Placid was. Yeah. But it's turned into a prison?
Yeah, it's like a low security. Part of it is like a low security prison.
Huh. That's a cool. It's called
Olympic City.
Olympic City.
Yeah.
Interesting.
It's a really beautiful, large scale photography book that if you Google it, I think the Guardian and other places write about the project because it's kind of a mixture of sort of, or maybe it's like looking at this weird, peculiar urban planning thing that happens that's totally anomalous to actual cities and the failures and successes of it, but from the street level up. And they're both really good street photographers. John's, artistically, John's an amazing street photographer. And he's a really, he's just somebody who I've developed a lot of the way I see the world as an adult alongside.
Oh, really? Yeah. So he's you met him in college, the same age?
Yeah.
New York dude now?
Yeah, he's been in Brooklyn since 96, maybe, 98.
Oh, so wow.
Somewhere along there. And he...
But still a close chum.
Yes.
Cool. Yeah,
really good friend.
All right. Those are the only two questions I had. Will you read some dreams or will you read some music stuff? Read anything you want.
All right. I have a peculiar and sort of unnecessarily agonistic approach to the dreams where I don't want to use them outside of the project of delivering them to people's doors. Like, I don't want to make a book of them and I don't want to like keep them. But at the same time, I'm not like popular or interesting enough to live off of this entirely without having examples. So
not true. Not
I
true.
Have
but
a couple that I sort of my go-to reading ones. This is a dream from the Dream Delivery Service. You're standing on a street corner pretending to be a tree. Some people walking by say things like, "What a beautiful tree." You're happy you've tricked them into thinking you're really a tree. Some people walking by say things like, "Look at how good that kid is at being a tree." And you're less happy about this, but still happy. Some of the people walking by don't say anything. Eventually, you get tired of being a tree, and you pretend to be a bookshelf. A person walking by stops and looks at all the books on your shelves. They say, consider picking up one book, but then change their mind. They say, again, and they say, again. Finally, they pick a book out of one of your shelves. They stand there and read the book for many minutes. They are made so happy by the book. Finally, they put the book back onto your shelf and walk away. You stop pretending to be a bookshelf, but you save the book the person was reading so you can read it too. When you open the book, it smells like dirt. Not dirty, not a bad smell, but like the dirt in a garden, dark and rich and full of life. Another one?
Yeah, let's do, if you don't mind.
You are in a field of corpses. You must be dead. Why else would so many dead surround you? You lie there among the dead, trying to feel what it means to be dead. It feels a lot like being alive. There's pain, discomfort, fear, itchiness, boredom. Eventually you get tired of being dead and you stretch and get to your knees and stand. One of the corpses beside you says, "Hey, no, get back down here." You shake your head. "It's too dull," you say, "being dead." "Well, you must be alive then," the corpse says. "If I'm alive," you say, "then you must be alive too, because you're talking." Corpse touches his face and moves his jaw around, feeling the movement. All around you, the eyes of the corpses follow you as you move and gesticulate. "I think we might all be alive, actually," you say. This is greeted by a chorus of harumphs and naysaying. "Here," you say. You crouch and hold the hands of a corpse and pull her to her feet. She stands, confused and anxious, swaying slightly. "Now you help one of the corpses up," you say to her. She crouches and grabs the hands of another corpse. This corpse tries to wave her hands away, but she leans to the corpse's ear and whispers something, and when she tries to lift the corpse up again, the corpse grabs her tightly and rises. You help more corpses to their feet, as the other corpses help more corpses up. To some, you give explanations. To some, you give hugs or just talk to them. To some, you give silence and space. And when the entire field of corpses has risen, you begin to march down the highway as a whole, a host of corpses, a host of the living.
Yeah. Thank you, Matthias.
Thanks.
You're listening to The Steer, recorded at KBOO Radio, broadcast on dublab.com, hosted by Jeff Alessandrelli and Sonny Bleckinger. For more, see our website at www.the-steer.com. You can download our episodes on iTunes, Stitcher, Player FM, and anywhere podcasts are found.